We've probably heard it. Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, special orders, don't upset us. Have it your way at, yes, Burger King. Now, some of you are young enough to not know that jingle, but the brilliance of Burger King's slogan marketing campaign back in 1974 was started to sum up the difference between how they would provide us a burger and how McDonald's provides us burgers. The special orders don't upset Burger King employees. They do upset McDonald's employees. Although there's been slight adjustments to the slogan, the song is a little bit different. The singers no longer wear those amazing red and yellow hats. The slogan, even at times, has made a little bit of a difference, but that slogan, have it your way, has defined that organization for years. And while some believe that the slogan is so popular because of that catchy jingle, it's more reasonable to believe that pop culture's emphasis on individuality and self-expression is really what has made Have It Your Way stick. For Have It Your Way seems to resonate with all of us, doesn't it? And not just because we want our burgers our way. We want things our way. We want things done our way. As this ad from 2004 rather profoundly exclaims, I do it my way. My ride is customized. My style is definitely my own. And that's how I want my food. The original Whopper, hot and fixed fresh with extra ketchup. My way. I won't have it any other way. Now, whether or not Burger King intentionally intended to feed the conceit inside each and every one of us with this slogan, no one really truly knows. But what we do know is that having it our way is a statement that goes far deeper than just our taste buds. Have it your way truly reveals our cravings for self-satisfaction and exaltation. We want it our way, whatever it might be. Well, if you were to ask me this morning what I'd title this chapter here in Judges, I wouldn't give it the title found there in the English Standard Version, Micah and the Levite. No, I'd entitled it, Have It Your Way. For you see, here in Judges 17, we begin to hear some cultural commentary on the nation of Israel during the time of the Judges. Having concluded his accounts of the 12 judges in chapter 16 with perhaps the worst of them all, Samson, the author now, in these next five chapters, will further expose the depth of Israel's spiritual corruption at this time. And what we'll see in the next 5 weeks is not all that pretty at all. In fact, we'll actually have to give some parental discretion as advised in the coming weeks. But what we come to find here in these next five chapters is that Israel is a complete and total failure. A complete and total failure. Having been rescued out of slavery in Egypt by God, given his covenant personal name, Yahweh, I Am, so that they would know that God chose them, not because of anything they've done, we're told in Deuteronomy 7, but because of his love and for his glory, they've graciously been given God's law to live by. They've been promised a land and then granted that land. And all of this was for the purpose of showcasing how utterly amazing Yahweh truly is. What the people of Israel have done is exactly the opposite. I mean, they've complained about their rescue. They've grumbled about their provisions. They've blatantly defied God's law and they've rejected God's leaders. At this point in the story, you could say Israel is that family you'd be questioning whether or not you'd want your children to go over to their house or tent at that time. And to top it all off, these were the staff kids in the church and the Christian school. You see, church, as we step into this cultural commentary within these chapters, we must not forget who he is talking about. See, these are the people God has rescued. These are his people that he has redeemed. He's revealed himself to these people. They are his people. And so what we find here is not the problem out there, it's the problem in here. What we find in these pages is not the problem with everybody else out there, it's the problem in here, in God's people. For what's true about every human heart is that we all have turned inward to crave our own exaltation. The Apostle Paul will say it like this to the church in Rome: "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or gave him thanks or give thanks to him, but they exchanged the glory of the immortal God. They exchanged it for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator," Romans 1. You see, this is the story of mankind. Have it your way. We have. And so, Paul continues, there is no one righteous. No, not one. Which is why we need a rescue, why we need, as the author of Judges will remind us again and again throughout these chapters, why we need a king. We need a king to rescue us from ourselves, from having it our own way. Here in Judges 17, we're introduced to a narrative that really won't conclude until the end of chapter 18. And so this morning, we won't conclude the story, we'll just begin to see the extent of Israel's abandoning of God for pagan gods, yes, but also for themselves. We'll see the sad reality here that as fallen, rebellious human beings, we even crave our own exaltation when worshiping God. And so from this chapter, we'll come to the conclusion that true worship demands a shift of center from self to God. Let me say that again. True worship demands a shift of center from self to God. For you see, when worship centers on me, it's actually not at all about God. When worship centers on me, it actually can't be about God. And so, this morning we're going to look at two phrases here that we find rooted in this text that reveal an attitude, or you could say a posture, of self-centered worship. And unfortunately, if we're honest with ourselves, it's not all that uncommon from what we may find ourselves saying at times. In verses 1 through 6, we'll hear, "I'll worship in my own way." And then in verses 7 through 13, we hear, "I'll worship for my own good." I'll worship in my own way, and I'll worship for my own good. Sound familiar at all? Well, let's look first of all at the posture of self-centered worship there in verses 1 through 6 that says, "I'll worship in my own way." The narrative begins here in chapter 17 by introducing us to a man named Micah. Micah is from the hill country of Ephraim. And now, to be clear, this is not the Micah for which a later book in the Bible is named. This is not the prophet Micah. However, as we'll see, he likes to think of himself as in a rather prophetic role. This Micah, whose name ironically means "who is like Yahweh," has, as the narrative continues, stolen from his mother and lied to her about it. If first impressions are lasting impressions, Micah's striking out. Right away, we can see some glaring issues this guy has. And unfortunately, as the story continues, his mother isn't all that better. Did you notice, as we read that this morning, what Micah's mother's response is? First of all, she utters a curse, which is another great first impression. And then in verse 2, she exclaims, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." I mean, this at best is confusing, and at worst, she's taking the name of the Lord in vain. Well, as we continue to see in this story, it just continues to spiral downhill. For after her lying thief of a son confesses and gives her back these 1,100 pieces of silver, she not only blesses him, but dedicates that money to the Lord, giving it back to her son so he can, of all things, go and make idols. I mean, you talk about bad parenting. I mean, this family is seriously messed up. Lying, stealing, excuse-making, taking the name of the Lord in vain. And then as the story continues, notice what Micah does in verse 5. He makes a shrine, an ephod, which is priestly garments, more household gods, and then ordains one of his sons to wear the ephod and become a priest. One commentator quips, breaking 7 of the 10 commandments without even leaving your house is quite an achievement. The contradictions in these verses are simply out of control. Micah steals and lies, but then confesses. His mother curses, but then blesses God. Dedicates the money to the Lord, but then has false idols made. Is anyone else confused with what's going on here? Perhaps this is why one author wrote, "In all my life so far, I have never heard a single reference from the pulpit or songwriter or study leader or anybody else at all. Never one single tiny whispered sound that related to the Micah of the book of Judges." Thanks, Matt, for giving me this passage. And then, he concluded, the reason is that this story is so crazy. It's so mixed up. And to think it's only the beginning of the story. We have a whole other chapter next week to find out more. And so what's going on here? What in the world is Micah, his mom, and now his ordained son, what are they doing? Well, I'm glad you asked, because I had that same question as I began studying this text. And thankfully, the author anticipates our question here. For did you notice what he said in verse 6? He steps aside from the narrative, and he gives us this cultural commentary on what's happening in the nation of Israel at this time. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. You see, here's what's going on. Micah's having it his own way. He's holding the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth, eighth, ninth, and tenth commandments because he wants it his way. Tim Keller notes, he has an inward spirit which does not want to submit to God as he is, but which wants to pick and choose attributes in order to create a God who is palatable. I'm sure many of you have heard similar sentiments shared by coworkers, by neighbors, even by family members. They begin by saying, "I really like to think of God as," and then continue by filling in whatever attribute they find to be most agreeable to themselves in that moment. I like to think of God as loving. I like to think of God as tolerant. I like to think of God as reasonable, and the list could go on and on. But don't forget, the problem is not so much out there as it is us in here. See, these are the people of God saying this, doing this, wanting it their own way. And so we have to ask ourselves from this text already, am I refusing to let God be himself in my life? In what areas am I looking for God to be more agreeable to my view? Have I created a God who, in my own understanding, is simply palatable for me? You see, the people of God have become so dismissive to his word and his ways that they no longer saw their need to be continually guided by it. Oh, his word was good for the generation before, but now it's irrelevant to us. His ways, oh, they worked in the good old days. Oh, but now, I mean, times have changed, haven't they? I'll worship in my own way. You see how so very subtly this posture of self-centered worship can begin to move us away from God. We drift from his word and his ways because we think our word and our ways are far better. And it happens to us in the same ways that it happened to Micah, with our money, our families, our homes. Oh, we may be liberated from idolatry to the toys of society, writes David Jackman. The cars, the boats, the airplanes, the swimming pools, the exotic trips, and even larger houses, but at the same time, in Christian circles, we can often substitute our own much more respectable and acceptable idol shrines. After all, if lots of the people worship there too, that gives the idol greater credibility. He goes on to say, an idol is anything that usurps the place of God because I'm looking to it to give me real life, to protect me or to enrich me. It's anything that squeezes God into the margins of my life because that thing has now become more worth or worth more to me than he is. So things like our marriage, things like our family life, the achievements of our kids, the success of our church, our position as a valued Christian leader or growing disciple. Again and again, it's I'll worship, I'll live my way. It's my way. I'll worship in my own way. Well, unfortunately, Micah isn't the only one believing this here in this time of the Judges. For the author tells us, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Oh, but only if, as the author, again, stepping to the side, is telling us, only if there was a king. If only there was a king to lead these people, to lead them out of their spiritual darkness. You see this repeated refrain from the author in these next several chapters of there was no king in Israel is a sign for us as readers. It's a sign for us to see who was needed to rescue these people from their I'll worship in my own way. They needed a king. For the judges who had gone before, well, they all struck out, didn't they? And so most assuredly a king would do better, or at least that's what the people thought. In fact, not too much later, another man from the hill country of Ephraim would have a son that through his wife Hannah, they would devote him to the Lord, a son named Samuel, a prophet chosen by the Lord to speak to the people of Israel and to judge them all the days of his life. If you would, turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 8, for it's here, after hearing that Samuel is judging, we hear what this cry for a king sounds like in the lips of the people. Starting in verse 4 of 1 Samuel 8, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel and they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. And so, the people continue to reject God's word and his ways. They reject God from being king over them. They want it their way. And as the story continues, they choose for themselves a king. They have their own way with a king who is tall, dark, and handsome, a king named Saul, who, if you're at all familiar with the story of Israel, doesn't cut it at all. I mean, he's just as bad as the judges who have gone before him. The king they needed fails them miserably, but God, and oh, those two words change everything, God has another man to step in, a man after his own heart, who leads the people faithfully, David. Well, that is, until he doesn't. You see, David wants it his own way too, and so the story continues. Time and time again, leader after leader, wanting it their own way, failing miserably. But you see, God had made a promise to David that his offspring would have a kingdom that would never end. He would be the rescuer king they needed, and he is the rescuer king we all need. Joseph, son of David, Do not fear to take Mary as your wife, Matthew 1:20 reads. For that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. For he will save his people from their sins. He will save his people from having it their own way. You see, Jesus is the rescuer king. The author of Judges is ultimately pointing us to. As author Dale Ralph Davis notes, our writer clearly has in mind a particular kind of king, a king who would uphold Yahweh's covenant standards, the kind of king, so the argument goes, who would have put a stop to such self-centered worship. And so, Jesus does. For when you and I shake our fist at God, saying, I want it my way, Jesus stepped into our place and said, not my will, but yours be done. Oh, friends, this is the good news of the gospel for you and for me. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, he made us alive with Christ. By grace, you have been saved. You have been saved from doing it your own way, from worshiping in your own way. Oh, friend, believe this good truth, this good news this morning. If you're here for the very first time, or maybe it's a thousandth time that you've been here, and you say, you know what, Pastor Dan, I've been doing it my own way all of my life. I've been trying hard. I've been trying to live this Christian life. I've been trying to obey. I've been doing it my own way. Here's the good news. You need a rescuer king, and that king has come in Jesus to rescue you from your own way, because he said, not my way, but yours be done. You see, Jesus rescues us from this self-centered worship. I'll worship in my own way. But we also see Jesus rescues us from the second attitude here in the text. I'll worship for my own good. We see this in verses 7 through 13. And if we thought first impressions of Micah were bad, these verses only further increase our opinion. And yet, before we get to Micah again, notice a new character is introduced here into the story. It's a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. Well, once again, first impressions are important. And from this guy's walk-up music, we can already tell this is going to be a significant change in the storyline. Micah was just a nobody from Ephraim. But this guy, I mean, he's somebody. I mean, he's a Levite. He's from Bethlehem in Judah. That sounds rather significant. But do you notice what he's doing? Notice what this Levite is doing in verses 7 and 8. Did you notice it? He's on the move. He sojourned there, and the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. He's left his hometown. He's looking for a better place. Now, here's the thing. That's not the norm for Levites. Levites were not itinerant priests who would go from city to city holding worship services for whoever wanted to come. No, Levites lived in certain cities for a reason. In fact, back in Joshua chapter 21, we're told of the cities given to the Levites by the command of the Lord to Moses. And neither Bethlehem nor Ephraim are listed. So what does this mean? Well, I think we have two options with this guy. He's either a victim of the people of Israel failing to support the Levites with the tabernacle and their ministry there, or number two, he's decided to just go it alone and do it his own way. And while both are certainly a result of Israel's spiritual corruption at the time, I'd have to conclude that this young man who's name is Jonathan, as we find out in chapter 18 and verse 30, is this guy's issue is he's just doing it his own way as well. He's doing what was right in his own eyes. For as the story continues, instead of standing up for God, his word and his ways, he becomes complicit to the false worship of Micah and his family. One author states, instead of seeking the mind of the Lord, Jonathan set out to find a place to live and work, even if it meant abandoning his call as a servant of God. He could have done something to bring the people back to God, but instead he was agreeable only to men. You see, this is how far God's people have gone away from him. Even the preacher is selling out to false gods. Well, Micah seizes the opportunity. He capitalizes on this moment, at least in his own perspective. I've got a Levite here. And so he offers Jonathan a job as his own personal priest. But notice, he gives him 10 pieces of silver a year. I mean, that's only 5% of what the idols cost him. I mean, man, what a deal to get a priest for only 5%. Jonathan accepts it. He moves in for that meager amount, is ordained, and becomes Micah's priest. He did it his way. And as the author states, he's content. Content to dwell there. But notice how in verse 13, the author doesn't have to conclude this scene with his own cultural commentary, because Micah's words say it all. Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as a priest. Now I know the Lord's going to bless me, because I've got a Levite as a priest. Son, move over. There's a new sheriff in town, and he's a Levite. He's going to take care of us. Four-leaf clovers in Ireland, painted dollar horses in Sweden, Chinese golden toads, Egyptian scarabs, Catholic rosary beads, suit coats, ties, ankle-length dresses, and whether a grasp one thing for good luck in your palm, wear them around your neck, or say you dress in a certain way, many believe such things bring favor with the divine, don't they? You can call it spiritual superstition. You can call it the prosperity gospel. You can call it legalism, but the reality is in each of those things, the root is still the same. It's saying, I'll worship for my own good. I'll worship my way, and when I worship my way, I'll worship for my good. Now, this is what Micah is not only believing here, he's so audacious enough in his state of spiritual disillusion to even say it. Now I know the Lord will prosper me. God has become his genie in a bottle. Now he's acquired just that right person for his household temple, a Levite. Now certainly God is going to bless me. He's going to grant my wishes. Do you see how twisted, self-centered worship can become? Reducing God to someone we can control rather than seeing him as the one in control. Oh, but Dan, do you really think we have an issue with superstition in our worship? I don't know if you've seen the commercial, the Geico commercial over the last couple of weeks, especially during the NCAA tournament. LSU fan is there in the middle of the screen and has it all decked out. He's sitting in the same place, making sure others are sitting in their respective places. He says, you know this is where I always sit. He's wearing the specific attire and making sure someone else is wearing that specific attire for the LSU game. And he even ends up slapping popcorn out of another guy's hand, saying, you didn't eat that last week. We got to eat the same thing, right? You guys have been there. You've seen that, right? Whether that's on the commercial or maybe it's in your household as you're hoping the Bears would finally win or something like that. That wasn't in the notes at all. Well, let me see. Do we struggle with that kind of superstition? You're all sitting in the same place this morning. You got your Sunday best on. Don't you dare bring popcorn into this sanctuary. Superstition? Maybe we'll just call it tradition. But could it be more than that for some of us? I'll worship for my good. You see, I don't think this belief is all that far from what we often believe about how God should work. We do something right. We do something good or holy. So then, of course, God is going to bless us. At least he should. I mean, he should prosper us because we're doing everything right. But once again, there's a subtle shift in who is at the center of our worship. Oh, it's certainly easier to see in others and to judge them for it, but what about us? Again, the problem's not so much them out there, but us in here. Again, as Tim Keller profoundly notes, we may not think that we believe in magic, but it's very easy to do so with a Christian veneer. Why do you think God will bless us? Sometimes we think he just will. He has in the past. He will today. At other times, we think he will bless us only if we push those right buttons, follow the correct recipe. And so we study the Bible. We pray. We go to church. We wear the right attire. We live rightly. Why? In order that we would be blessed. We would be strengthened by God. Oh, don't get me wrong. Those are all good things that we should do. But when they usurp the place of God in our affections for God, then God is no longer at the center of our worship. We are. And when God is no longer at the center, then who is it that we are worshiping? Me. I want it my way. I'll worship in my own way. I'll worship for my own good. But you see, friends, true worship demands a shift of center from self to God. I'll worship in his way. I worship for his glory. And so, friends, who's at the center of your worship? Who's the center of your life? I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Here in Judges 17, we see everyone doing what was right in his own eyes. Again, I don't think it's all that far from what could be said about us, even within the church today, in here. Worshiping in my own way, worshiping for my own good. Oh God, help us to see a true and better King who has rescued us from our self-centered worship. So, Father, I pray that for us here at Calvary Baptist Church, that we would not hear your word and look down our noses at others in judgment, but we would look to ourselves today. That as your word has done the work of piercing our souls, helping us discern the thoughts and intents of our heart, maybe today, these two phrases have been subtly resonating in our own hearts. And we, as your people, need to repent from worshiping our own way and worshiping for our own good. And in faith, turn and place you truly at the center of our lives. Father, if there is one here this morning that does not know you as the rescuer King, God, I pray that they would believe today, that they would repent of their sins, turn in faith to you, so that they can know that they have a rescue.